Is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Vigil today at Florida State University honoring the two people who were killed and six others wounded in a shooting rampage Thursday. Student Madison Eskins remains in the hospital. She says when the shooting started, she played dead.
I wanted to call my dad, tell him I loved him. So that was rough.
At the airport after returning from a visit in El Salvador with Kilmer Abrego Garcia, Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen says that the Trump administration is not complying with the court order for the man's return to the U.S.
It's about protecting the constitutional rights of everybody who resides in the United States of America. Yes!
The judge overseeing the Brian Koberger upcoming trial in Idaho has some key rulings that'll impact how the case unfolds. Evidence of Koberger's alleged autism spectrum disorder to explain his demeanor only to be allowed at the trial if Koberger testifies. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
The Bucks head to Indy. I'm Mike Clemens with sports. NBA playoffs game one. The Pacers host the Bucks tomorrow at noon. Damian Lillard back at practice. Just 4 weeks after being diagnosed with a blood clot in his right leg. How did he look? Head coach Doc Rivers.
You know, we didn't go a lot live today, but he was in practice throughout practice today. You know, and now we just got to see where he's at physically.
Baseball, the Brewers opening a three-game series tonight against the A's at American Family Field. The NFL draft coming up next week in Green Bay. How's the Packers roster? Mark Murphy.
You know, it takes a while for young players, even really talented ones, to really figure out the NFL. And usually by their third, fourth year, they're really, you know, really understand the game. And I know Brian, I think, has made some comments about we need to start competing for championships. And, you know, we're the Green Bay Packers. We, you know, it's all about winning championships.
That's Packers President Mark Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
Ross calling in.
Thanks for your show. I'm just wondering if we're watching or witnessing a legal system that where what we thought was precedent is now going to be sort of cast away.
The reality is the question that you raise about the future and what are the implications when in fact the things we understood always to be bedrocks of our community, of our nation, are no longer that.
Amicus, a law review, Saturday mornings from 9 to 11. This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Interesting email day yesterday after our conversations about Mr. Garcia, the sheet metal worker who was deported improperly, immorally, illegally, and sent to an El Salvadorian prison who, and as I said, look, I don't know that the man's still alive. I got a lot of responses from people that evidently hit a note with people. This idea that our government is going to take people, ship them to their deaths is not something that sat well. And good. The idea of that we might be shipping American citizens because they disagree with their government out of the country got some people's attention, got folks fired up, concerned, and some red hats along with it. We are in an interesting moment because as you're watching all of these attacks that are going on, you can easily go, wow, that's just outside. And understand, the right wing, they don't mind lying. They don't mind making things up. The right wing media sphere, they've been BSing us for decades. So saying that this guy, this Mr. Garcia, who's now hopefully in an El Salvadorian prison, hopefully on his way back home, if Senator Chris Van Hollen can bring him back, hopefully, If they can go and rewrite this guy's life and make him out to be a terrorist because he had maybe a run-in with law enforcement at a Home Depot while he was looking for work, or maybe had an argument with his wife. Now we've got all of this rewriting. He's MS-13. Well, maybe not, but, you know, he's a bad guy. It's interesting to watch the right-wing media sphere. And I gotta say, look, my red hat friends, look what you're being fed. Pay attention to what they're shoving down your throat, because it ain't good. And understand, as they come for each segment of the others, that's one more group to go before they come for you. And surprisingly, a number of emails on that vein going, hey, you know, I believe this. Do you think I'm next? You know, Rick, you talked about labor rights. They're eviscerating labor rights. Does that mean anybody who believes in labor unions could be suspect? Yes, that's exactly what I said. And I stand by that. Because authoritarians don't want empowered workers. They want obedient workers. And don't be surprised when Republicans come out and say, we support unions. And don't be surprised when a number of labor leaders go, yeah, we're supporting Republicans. So that, well, you know, understand, they got unions in China. They had unions in the Soviet Union. They got unions in where's that place over in Korea? They got unions in those places. They don't have any power. They don't have any say. They have no voice. They have no ability to advocate for themselves. But, you know, they're in unions. Unions in name only. And as long as they stand by dear leader, as long as they don't question too much, as long as they don't demand too much, as long as they don't ask too many questions, they can eat. Not much more. The future that we're looking down the barrel of is not a great one for our children. Which is why the saying, if bad things are going to happen, let's get through it now while I can fight it. While this moment where we can take this on so our kids don't have to. My grandparents came home from World War II and fought this battle so that their children and their grandchildren could have better lives. And now it's being eviscerated by the richest man in the world and a billionaire philanderer who, well, evidently plays golf once in a while and wins tournaments when he doesn't even play. But these are the people who are going to save us. That's the messaging, right? You know who's going to save us? You, me, us. We together. That's how we save this country. And we do it through our labor movement. So yeah, am I bullish on the labor movement? You bet your behind I am. Because I think we can do this. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the attacks on workers, I got to tell you, fast and furious everywhere we turn, this administration is going after the rule of law, going after organizing, and deporting apprentices, well, to an El Salvadorian prison, and then gone, we won a case we lost. it's quite remarkable where we are, and should scare every working person. As I've been saying, this homegrown thing, this should be very frightening to anyone who's ever carried a union card or differed in opinion from anything in this administration. And here to share some thoughts on where we are with labor rights, where we are with labor law, and where things are going, I've asked John Logan to come talk with us. He's a professor and the chair of labor, the Labor and Employment Studies Program at San Diego State University. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Happy to be here.
So, you know, I'm sure you saw the comment this week like everyone else. While Trump was talking to the El Salvadorian president, tells him he's going to have to build 5 more prisons because they got homegrowns here. I think of myself. I think of you. Homegrown?
Yeah, no, I'm immigrants, and everyone in my family are immigrants from elsewhere. And as you said, I mean, like, you know, the Trump administration is going after people who it thinks are easy targets, who are particularly vulnerable. I mean, obviously, we have seen some reaction to it on the part of the labor movement. You know, we were talking earlier and I was saying, well, you know, I'm worried that there's large sections of the labor movement that might be attracted to the Trump economic agenda, you know, tariffs, economic nationalism, America first, you know, anti-immigration. And that's true. And the building trades, obviously, you know, historically has been one of the more conservative parts of the labor movement. So it's always that danger. But actually, there's a period 100 years ago where the building trades were at the forefront of fighting American oligarchs, you know, and so, and I've seen very good reaction. I mean, I'm sure you've seen it too, the president of SMART, you know, talking about their member and, you know, send them back now. You know, we have other people in the building trades who have spoken up very, very clearly on this. So, I, you know, that obviously is the type of response we need from labor leaders at this point. Because I'll tell you, in higher education too, and I know a lot of people might not be most sympathetic to, but, you know, a couple of things. I mean, higher education is a very broad tent in the United States. It's not all Harvard and Yale and Princeton. You know, I teach at a university where it's primarily first-generation students, working-class students, lots of students of color, and so forth. And there's a huge amount of fear amongst students, political activists, student labor activists, you know, people. You hear so many stories about, you know, students wanting to have their names removed from op-eds that they wrote because they're worried that they will become a target, you know, for some ICE raid. It used to be the case that, you know, they had unions. I mean, obviously the UAW represents a large number of graduate student workers, of postdocs, but, you know, undergraduates are now organizing too at my campus. And, you know, we have the biggest undergraduate student worker union in the country now. So it used to be that their union, if they were the victims of harassment, if they were the victims of retaliation because of their free speech, because of their political activism, because of the labor activism, their union could file charges with the NLRB. It can't do that anymore. You know, and in fact, you know, the unions that are representing students are absolutely trying to avoid any interaction with the Trump NLRB, because they know that the first chance the Trump NLRB gets, it will use the case to overturn unionization and collective bargaining rights for student workers, certainly at private universities.
Yeah.
You know, obviously public universities, it's different to state law. You know, we've seen it, as you know, they removed collective bargaining rights from 47,000 TSA workers at the stroke of a pen. We've seen it now, an attack on collective bargaining rights for hundreds of thousands of federal workers. Trump administration is out to fundamentally weaken it. And, you know, it's all laid out in Project 2025.
Yeah, this is all stuff, John, that, you know, during the campaign we were talking about. So there should be no surprise. There should be no one out there going, we voted for cheaper eggs. We didn't want this. There should be nobody who gets to say that.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, the public sector unions, federal unions, public sector unions have very clearly got a target on their backs. You know, the Project 2025 people have seen no place for them whatsoever. You know, ideologically, they want to shrink the size of the state. So public sector unions are the most effective defense of public services. So they want to get rid of them for that reason. Public sector unions, it's true, to an extent, you live by politics, you die by politics. So they do give a lot of money to pro-union political candidates, and the right hates them for that reason. So it wants to kill them for that reason. And then when you look at the kinds of people who tend to belong to public sector unions, there are more younger people, there are more people of color, there are more women, there are more college-educated people, all of them unlikely to be supporters of the Trump agenda. Right. So they really want to destroy federal unions, obviously part of the agenda to shrink the size of and privatize the federal government. And they want to really attack public sector unions. Private sector, you know, as we were discussing, it's a little bit more complicated because you have people, certainly the people who are serious about their right-wing populism, you know, people like J.D. Vance, Josh Hawley, Marco Rubio, you know, all of whom are influenced by this guy, Orrin Cass, who has a book that everyone should read, by the way. I mean, he's a very conservative guy, but the Once and Future Worker gives you a really good insight into, like, you know, how right-wing populists want to capture parts of the labor movement. So they don't want to destroy unions like the Teamsters and the building trades, the steel workers. They want to co-opt them. You know, they want them to be on their side because they think that the membership of those unions are often far more conservative than the leadership. Obviously, sometimes they've had, you know, help from they've been able to get leaders on their side. But they think that these people should be part of their political constituency, their political coalition. So, you know, it's a very dangerous time for the labor movement. And we don't really know where we're going to be in 5 years' time, at the end of the Trump administration. But it's absolutely essential that, you know, the labor movement, you know, fight against what's going on at the moment and fight together. I mean, you know, if he's effective at dividing people, sort of saying, oh yeah, I'll promise you guys this, you know, you can, you know, have some say over who Secretary of Labor pick is, or I'll, you know, help you guys with tariffs, which are not going to bring any unionized jobs the way that Trump is doing them. That will be a disaster. I mean, the labor movement has to speak with a unified voice, and it has to realize that, you know, that this administration stands absolutely in opposition to everything positive that the labor movement represents.
No, it's an interesting point that you bring up, and it's something that I've talked about in the past, that the right wing wants to co-opt labor. Yeah. Because look, the members, right wing radio has been in their ear for 40 years now. Yeah. And I've said this before, I had a front row seat to watching how Rush Limbaugh and the right wing voices invaded our lunchroom and divided it. There had been a time that I remember where the business agent would walk in and go, hey, these are the people that we're supporting in the next election because they're good for our issues. And everybody would pick up a card and go, yep, this is who we're going to vote for. And because of that division in the lunchroom, you now have a situation where if the business agent comes in and says, this is who we're supporting, and if it ain't all Republicans in my neck of the woods, well, that business agent better run because they've stopped talking to their members, whereas the right filled that void and has been in their ear 24/7, 365, feeding them all kinds of nonsense. In fact, it's the reason I started this show 20 years ago, because a guy told me we'd make more money in this place if there was no stinking union and I wouldn't have to pay no dues. And I simply asked the question of, if that's true, why are you here? And he never thought about it before because no one ever put that in his head. So, you know, he had 40 years of learning by osmosis. This is what we've got.
No, it is absolutely essential. I mean, we've talked about this before, but I mean, the Democrats and the labor movement need it more than ever. You know, part of the problem is, as you said, like, you know, because of these dreadful free trade agreements that we've had, you know, since the 1990s, you know, entry of China into the WTO, the economy that sort of sustained a middle class lifestyle in the sort of upper Midwest and large parts of the country just, you know, fell apart, you know, far more quickly than most people anticipated, and is not being replaced by good jobs. And the Democrats have had no answers. I mean, you know, the answer to reconstructing an economy in which, you know, people throughout the country and not just in the, you know, places like New York and Boston and San Francisco can all get good jobs, high paying jobs, decent jobs. It's very complicated. You know, it's not an easy, there's no easy solutions. You know, Trump will have you believe there are easy solutions. There aren't easy solutions, but you at least need to talk to people. You need candidates who can speak the same language as they do. And, you know, the Democrats have been very bad at that. And the labor movement, frankly, has been bad at it too. So, you know, shows like yours, but, you know, we need so much, you know, we need that, you know, 1,000 times over.
Yeah, because look, the right has spent billions of dollars because they understand messaging works. They understand if they can get into your ear, in your eyeball, that they can convince you that up is down and down is up and right is left and black is white. They can convince you. Give me enough time and repetition, you can convince anybody of anything. And we're seeing that as a working class is cheering on Elon Musk, slashing and destroying jobs and harming workers' ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. You've got a working class, certain segment, cheering that on.
Yeah, no, and again, you mean this has been building, and you know, as you know, I mean, I you know, long before Scott Walker was elected governor of Wisconsin in 2010, you know, I was saying to people, you know, the Heritage Foundation are really targeting public sector unions. You know, they're saying this is the key to weakening the Democratic Party and weakening labor rights. You know, if we can undermine the finances of public sector unions, that really is a sort of key step in sort of, you know, instituting the type of sort of far right political rule. And so, you know, Scott Walker comes along. First thing he does is to, you know, divide unions into sort of good and bad unions, you know, like public sector teachers, you know, graduate assistants, no more collective bargaining for them. The only ones he kept it for were police and first responders. But, you know, what, and then you had like this right-wing network, you know, the American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, all these groups funded by the Koch brothers, et cetera, you know, funding these copycat bills all over the place. And this is exactly the same way that we got Project 2025, which is basically an attempt to implement the same type of plan, except that, you know, it was a blueprint for what they were going to do at the federal level. But, you know, Pope Wisconsin, I mean, Wisconsin should have been a wake-up call, because it really showed us that the sort of politics of resentment were actually sort of like very deep in this country. You know, these public sector workers, you know, they have pensions. I don't have a pension in my private sector job. Why should they have pensions? And as you say, the right doesn't have any solutions. And it doesn't, you know, it says things that are, you know, patently untrue, but it's very good with coming up with arguments that resonate with people, that appeal to their sort of base instincts. And, you know, that's what we have to fight against.
Right.
You know, there's sort of like, you know, when the economy, collapses in parts of the country because of the, you know, the crappy trade deals and the corporations that don't care about American workers and where they manufacture, and, you know, Democrats don't have any solutions, they're very vulnerable to a demagogue like Trump, you know, riding in his white horse and saying, you know, here, I have the solutions. And, You know, that's what's happened. But it's very dangerous time for the labor movement. You know, we've kind of gotten into this sort of like, you know, mentality that, you know, well, it's really difficult, you know, to raise union density, but it just sort of continues to fall at about 0.5% per year. So, you know, it's not a disaster. You know, we're still at, there's nothing to say that it has to fall at 0.5% per year. I mean, you know, we could be in a situation in 4 years' time. You know, public sector workers now represent almost half of the labor movement, you know, 50% of union members in this country. If, you know, as a result of 4 years of right-wing populism, public sector unions are really decimated. I mean, you know, and then, you know, parts of the private sector too, that, you know, the Trump, you know, you've got immigration raids, you've got, like, you know, unions like Unite Here, SEIU, some of the others that have, like, large numbers of immigrant workers in, you know, in their ranks, and have, you know, in the past been sort of, like, you know, quite vocal in opposition to the Trump administration, they, you know, could be fundamentally weakened. So we really don't know where we're going to be in 4 years' time. We really can't take anything for granted, even though, you know, one thing, and I don't want to be too pessimistic, but, you know, people say, well, you know, union density in the private sector, you know, it's about 6%. I mean, it's actually below 6%, as we know now from last year. But that's where we were 100 years ago. But, you know, in a way, 100 years ago, the labor movement had a much firmer basis than it did today. It was really based in the, you know, in the trades and in the guilds, you know, like, you know, it was a sort of form of occupational unionism in a way that the labor movement is more fragile today than it was 100 years ago, even although, you know, percentage-wise, it sort of like represents a sort of similar. So, yeah, I mean, it's very worrying times, you know. I mean, we'll see.
See, where I go with this, John, and where I'm going to be a little bit optimistic is, I think all of the horrible stuff that they're going to do that's yet to come will create enough suffering that people finally find each other. And I've been saying, if you want to reunite this country, you got to reunionize it. And I think that's the vehicle that will bring us back together and give us that kind of militancy to fight for that prosperous working class that we once had. But I think we have to go through some pain and misery first before people wake up and go, whoa, wait a second. That's why they're trying to kill it. So for me, that's the hopeful part of this. But for you, the last question I've got for you, because you know, ultimately, as you hit on a moment ago, it's about going after any dissent, and at the university level, especially. And I look at Ro Khanna, who was at the Yale Law School, who, speaking about J.D. Vance, and how Vance not only declared war on the courts, but on universities. Khanna said it's no accident. As Stephen Kotkin observed in his study of Stalin, strong men don't fear recession or even failed wars as much as they feared the university. So an educated populace, one that might not be swayed by this, which is why people like you have to be torn down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, you have all of these people like Vance and Josh Hawley, all of whom are products of these elite universities. You know, they all benefited from, like, you know, Harvard and Yale and Princeton. This is where they went. Their law degrees are from, you know, then they went to the Goldman Sachs, then they went to the investment banks. Now they're pretending that, you know, that they represent this sort of genuine working class vision, that, you know, that they're standing against elites. I mean, it's all nonsense. Of course, we know it's nonsense. But I agree with your optimism, too. I mean, even though I said we're in a very dangerous position, but I do think that, you know, we have to make the argument that, you know, it's only through organizing. And, you know, it's not, you know, the institutions of the labor movement are far from perfect. We all know that's true. But, you know, if you look at the labor movement as a sort of process rather than an institution, the process by which people, you know, get together and defend their collective rights at the workplace, I mean, that's more relevant than ever before. You know, that's more important than ever before. And it really is the last line of defense against, you know, what we're going to face over the next 4 years. So, I agree with you. I think there is grounds for optimism. I think it's really the not just the best hope. I mean, it might be the only hope,
the last
of resisting this sort of proto-fascism we're seeing, before our eyes. But I think, we saw, lots of hopeful signs over the past 2 or 3 years. That sort of like energy and activism amongst young people has not gone away. I think it's still there. I think if we can have, bold and clear leadership, at the labor movement, that people are ready, to stand up against this.
And hit the streets. It's what we got to do. And we'll see. May Day's coming right around the corner. But, John, yeah. I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Come back and talk to us again real soon.
Yeah. Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend John Logan, professor there at San Diego State University. And I got to ask, one of the ones maybe got to worry about being sent somewhere? And are you worried? Should be. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to the Talk of Lacrosse, Eagle 1490 AM. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy, maybe a shower tonight, a low in the upper 30s. Mostly sunny for tomorrow, high upper 50s. Increasing clouds Sunday, showers developing, high temperatures in the mid-50s. Showers continue Sunday night and linger on into Monday morning. Currently 51 degrees.
This message is sponsored by WiskCaregiver.com. Now is the time to start a meaningful career as a caregiver. Make a real difference in people's lives. WiskCaregiver.com gives you two great options for free. Train for the in-demand caregiver workforce as a CDCP, Certified Direct Care Professional, or become a CNA, Certified Nurse Aide. All training is free. Plus, you can earn a $500 bonus. Learn more. Visit WiskCaregiver.com.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday on the program, we talked about the anti-worker corporate front group, a coalition for a democratic workplace. And I got to tell you, I love these cute and fluffy, we love puppies kind of names. Because look, democratic workplace coming from a corporate front, really? Anyway, what they have now gotten attention for is they sent a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi. They're basically asking her to overturn the entire Biden era and the NLRB decisions that came out of that. Basically, any progress that was done during the Biden years, they want it overturned with the stroke of a pen. No hearing, no appeals, no challenging, nothing, just stroke of a pen. So anything that workers were gaining during the Biden years to organize, fight for better wages, hours, and conditions, they want Pam to overturn. And here to share some thoughts on, is this new? Did I miss this? Is this something that's historic? Or is this, something that was just dreamed out of whole cloth? That's why I've asked Lynn Reinhart to come talk with us. Lynn's a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. You can check out their website, epi.org. Lynn, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, look, my red hat friends would say, well, Joe Biden, he did all kinds of stuff. Is this Joe Biden-esque?
This is absolutely unprecedented. And, just really kind of breathtaking in what the employer group is seeking to have done. And you're right, the Coalition for Workplace Democracy, we're all for workplace democracy, and the best way to have workplace democracy is for workers to be able to come together and form a union. This group is not about that. This group sprung out of the fight to stop the Employee Free Choice Act, which would have given workers more of a choice to form and or join a union. So they're not about democratic workplaces. They're about taking power away from workers and giving it to employers. So what they're trying to do here is, as you say, ask Attorney General Pam Bondi to reverse the greatest hits of the NLRB during the Biden administration with the stroke of a pen, not through the usual course of action, which is you file an appeal or you file arguments before the agency, the NLRB, the expert independent agency that knows labor law, and ask them to revisit their decision. They don't want to go down that road. They just want Pam Bondi to get rid of these decisions that they don't like, which I might add include a decision that goes after Elon Musk and Tesla for illegal conduct. They just want her to get rid of those decisions with the stroke of a pen so that they don't have to worry about them anymore. It's radical. It's unprecedented. And honestly, I can't see how this is actually in employers' best interest to have labor law dictated by a single individual as opposed to through a process and an expert independent agency.
Yeah, because this is one
so
of those
far
things,
we haven't heard much from employers about this.
This is one of those things that could be you live by the sword, you die by the sword, because you know a Democrat may take over and they may find a Democrat with a spine to say, hey, if you did this, we can do it. But this just seems to me to be lazy. I mean, you know, you've got a president who doesn't seem to mind firing people. He could pack the NLRB with sycophants and anti-worker folks, and he's going to, and just you know, go through the process of going, yeah, we're gonna enact all this horrible stuff. That would be the way it's always been done, as opposed to stroke of a pen, we're just gonna wipe everything out. But I guess that's how it came, right? That's how this is the arguments being made because of one of Trump's executive orders.
That's exactly right. This comes on the heels of an executive order that one of the many, many executive orders that President Trump issued. This one was it's really a power grab by the president trying to take over and control what Congress set up to be independent agencies. And it's the National Labor Relations Board, but it's not just the National Labor Relations Board. It's the Federal Trade Commission. It's the EEOC. It's a whole variety of independent agencies, expert agencies that Congress set up to regulate business and their practices as they pertain to consumers, as they relate to workers. So what the president wants to do is basically control those agencies. He wants to control them by firing people and putting his own people in place and by controlling their actions. And in this executive order, the president said that the attorney general can dictate the law. So this employer coalition has picked up on that and they've said, great, we like that. Dictate the law and get rid of these 12 Biden era decisions that we don't like. Let's not follow the usual process. Let's just have the attorney general declare the law. And you're exactly right. The shoe's going to drop on the other foot, or that's the wrong, I'm mangling the expression, but you get the idea. It isn't always going to be Pam Bondi sitting in the attorney general's chair. Are employers going to like it when a pro-union attorney general decides that employers have to recognize unions voluntarily through card check recognition because they just want it that way and they say so? It's just a bad idea. It's a much better idea to have due process and have an agency review the matter and consider arguments and make a decision, which is the way it's been done for 90 years and has worked quite well. So it's a really radical idea. I don't know what the administration is going to do with their request for this, but I sure would like to see some reasonable employers step up and say, you know, that's actually not the labor relations system that we want. We want stability. We don't want this back and forth, depending on who's holding the pen in the attorney general's office.
Yeah, but if you're an employer, you see an opportunity for a massive power grab like this to put a dagger in the heart of the labor movement, at least for these 4 years, knowing that you've got the upper hand in a lot of these cases. I don't see that profile and courage coming from the CEO suites to save what bit of what's left. I would argue what's left of the peace treaty of the past with labor management relations. So I'm not going to hold my breath for that. But you used two words there that you know, we've been kind of focused on the last couple days. You said due process. This administration, I don't know, they don't seem to be all that thrilled with due process. And in fact, I've been asking a lot of people, are you now going to be considered a homegrown, being one of those labor radicals? Because, you know, you remember the Pastor Niemöller quote, you know, first they came for the trade unionists and I said nothing. So, you know, something you're thinking about?
Every day. It's really scary. There does not seem to be a lot of due process happening in this country. There also doesn't seem to be much compliance with court orders. Looking for due process for people who are being treated under, you know, just inexcusably awful conditions. So it's extremely worrisome. And you're right, this is yet another example of just throwing due process to the wind and trying to just run things by edict, yeah, as opposed to through a democracy.
So for me, Lynn, and this is where this kind of comes together. You look at what they've taken a union member. They've put him in an El Salvadorian prison. They refuse 9-0 Supreme Court rulings that, hey, you got to bring him back. They say, no, we won 9-0. We don't have to. And I ask my union member friends, when do they start coming for you? When does your collective bargaining rights be taken away, as we've seen on the federal level? When does this stuff trickle down? Because if they can petition the attorney general to, with a stroke of a pen, undo labor law and labor rights in this country, do you have any rights if you don't have due process? So for me, all this stuff comes together. You know, this is right now an agency most people don't even know exists in the National Labor Relations Board, but it's another in a huge, huge picture of this kind of abuse that everyone should be worried about, especially my union brothers and sisters.
Absolutely. And while we're going through the list of problematic actions, let's add to that list the fact that Donald Trump shut down the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, which is there to assist the collective bargaining process. It was set up by Congress to assist the collective bargaining process. It's not a regulatory agency. It doesn't order anything. It just helps the parties reach agreements and resolve disputes. And in the name of, quote, cost savings, they've essentially shut down an agency that assists with the collective bargaining process. So fortunately, workers who do have a union and do have a union contract have a enforceable union contract in effect now.
Maybe.
But now. But it's pretty scary the speed with which this administration is attacking workers' rights. And we haven't even gotten into what's happening to the federal workforce, which is it's just appalling and outrageous and illegal. And hopefully the courts will declare it as such.
No, but you look at this, and again, there doesn't seem to be any guardrails in this moment for what they're willing to do. And at the end of this, it's got to come back to asking the very simple question of, because you've said this a couple of times, this was mandated by Congress. This was enacted by Congress. This is an act of Congress. You've said that a couple of times. You know where I'm going. Where's Congress?
I would think that members of Congress of both parties would be pretty upset that the president has taken away their power. The president has fired a Senate confirmed member of the National Labor Relations Board, who the Senate approved for a 5-year term, and the president fired her without cause back in February and said, "I did it because I think I can." He stripped them of their role, their constitutional role in the nominations process. And I will say, we've seen amicus briefs, we've seen some statements. I don't know that I've seen anything in terms of the shutdown of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, which was established by Congress. So it would be great to see more action and comments coming out of Congress loss of their power.
And look, my red hat friends, the people who voted for all of this, you can't want the end of labor law in this country. You can't want to have an attorney general with a stroke of a pen undo any progress in your ability to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. So contact your red hat senators and congressmen and maybe say, grow a spine, do something, because we desperately need this. Now, as I've been saying throughout all of this, the last line of defense for democracy, I believe, in our country is not our elected leaders. It's not our courts, because this administration not going to listen. It is the labor movement. It is the labor leaders. It is the power of organized workers. It's the people taking to the streets. And I see here recently the AFL-CIO and a number of unions have come together and finally built a legal network to try and fight back to some of this. Can you talk a little bit about what this looks like and what the hope is out of it?
Sure. It's really exciting. The AFL-CIO, a number of unions, Democracy Partners, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights have come together to put together a legal network that will provide free legal services to federal workers who either need advice or have been fired or have been laid off, whether they're union or non-union. This is the labor movement and allies coming together to assist workers who need advice on exercising their rights at work. Which is the first time something like this has been put together. It's a really needed, important initiative. And it comes along with You've, I'm sure, seen that the labor movement has filed more than a dozen, probably more than two dozen lawsuits against the Trump administration to try to stop some of the illegal actions that he's taking against federal workers, again, about shutting down the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service. There was a lawsuit filed on that a couple days ago. So the unions have been busy trying to save workers' rights and, frankly, save democracy from this administration. And this latest legal network initiative is the latest piece in that.
No, it's important. Look, earlier in the week, we had Jimmy Williams Jr. on, the painters president, and he was saying, look, we got to file these lawsuits. And we've got to get court decisions if we're going to have any direct action. Because I bet a lot of people said, hey, how come labor's not having a general strike? How come we're not shutting things down? And I said, look, I think you have to have the justification before you have the action. And I think going to court is the right thing, getting those decisions. And when they refuse to honor those decisions, then I think there's action. But not until then. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Not being an elected labor leader, I'm the last person who's going to talk about whether or not there should be a general strike.
Oh, come on. But as an activist.
Let's take it a step at a time. Let's see how we do. Let's see how we do in the courts. Let's see how we do with some of these mobilizations and protests that have been happening all over the country. And hope that some of this gets through and stops some of what's been happening to working people.
Yeah. No, I've been saying, look.
And I know maybe this sounds Pollyannish, but it really does seem to me, as somebody who's, you know, spent her career in the collective bargaining labor management space, it really does seem to me like we are at a point where responsible employers ought to be speaking up and saying, you know what, this is not good for labor management relations. This is not good for business. This is not good for our economy to be melting down the system like we're seeing.
No, I don't disagree with you. I don't know that we have those profiles encouraged, but we'll see. Lastly, how many of these wonderfully named, euphemistically named front groups are out there? I mean, because I vaguely remember this from the past. It's not tip of my tongue. I think about, you know, the union facts people and the fairness people. I think of all of those, but it's all of these nice flower, the Coalition for a Democratic Workplace. Lynn, who could be against that?
Me, for one, right? when it says described by this organization. So you make a really good point. You got to look behind the name and find out what's really going on. And this is a group that's been advocating against workers' rights and against unions since its formation 20, 30 years ago to fight legislation that would have strengthened workers' rights. So don't be fooled by the nice, fuzzy name. What they're advocating here is really dangerous and really radical. Yeah. And hopefully it just ends up on a shelf someplace and we don't have to have another program where we talk about Pam Bondi granting their requests. That would be scary, scary stuff indeed.
I'd love to have another program where we don't talk about Pam Bondi at all. But we'll, okay. we'll take yours first. But Lynn, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts with us. I hope you come back and talk to us again real soon.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Good stuff. Lynn Reinhart, senior fellow there at the Economic Policy Institute. You can check out their work, epi.org. Fabulous stuff. You want to check that out, epi.org. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you love the name? Center for Dogs and Puppies. We love apple pie. While all hating workers, want to hear your thoughts? rick@therickSmithShow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1857. That was the day that Clarence Darrow was born in Kinsman, Ohio. Darrow was perhaps the original U.S. labor lawyer. Known to be a friend to underdogs, Darrow once supposedly said, quote, "Lost causes are the only ones worth fighting for." Clarence learned his concern for his fellow man from his family. His childhood home was a stop on the Underground Railroad. In 1887, Clarence moved to Chicago to pursue his law career. But his first big client was not an underdog. In fact, he ended up working as the general counsel for the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. But then the 1894 strike by Pullman workers led him to quit his job. And instead, he defended Eugene V. Debs, the president of the American Railway Union. Debs had been imprisoned for his support of the striking Pullman workers. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Although Darrow lost, his reputation as a lawyer for labor was sealed. Over the years, he would go on to successfully defend Big Bill Haywood, leader of the Industrial Workers of the World, when he was accused of murder. Darrow's most well-known case, however, was the Scopes trial. Darrow defended a high school teacher, John Scopes, who had the audacity to teach evolution to high school students in Tennessee, something that was quite controversial at the time. The trial became a major news event. 200 reporters from across the nation covered the case. Darrow won, which was seen as a major shift towards the teaching of science in the classroom. Clarence Darrow is still beloved in Chicago, which holds a ceremony each year remembering his work as a champion of the people. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I know I can hear my red hats now. The NLRB's a bureaucracy. They're the bureaucrats. The bureaucrats. Yeah, that's the argument. That's the only argument without ever understanding what the NLRB is. It's just, they're all bad. It's all bureaucrats. Now understand, the National Labor Relations Act was established in 1935. It served what I argue is a crucial piece of legislation that acted really as a peace treaty between labor and management. It fundamentally reshaped the landscape for industrial relations. You know, prior to it being passed into law, the relationship between workers and bosses and owners and employers was master and servant, dictatorial. You work for me. You do what I say. And workers kind of pushed back. There were a lot of strikes. There was a lot of conflict. There was stuff that went on. In fact, my grandparents' generation, I know because they told me, my grandparents' generation, otherwise known as the people who went overseas during World War II to fight fascism and blew a lot of things up, they came home and were blowing a lot of things up, fighting fascism in the workplace. And I know that because my grandfather was very clear, don't do these things. We did it so you don't have to. Sadly, if he were still with us, you got to wonder. Because that generation, they weren't taking the poverty wages, they weren't taking the horrible, deplorable working conditions, they weren't taking any of that. This was a generation who fought a world war. And they said, you know what? We're going to share in some of the prosperity. Happy days are here again. And what the NLRA did is it established a legal framework so that workers' rights were recognized. The ability to organize, to collectively bargain. In fact, collective bargaining in the law is encouraged. And the government's role is to push in that direction. Because what they want, what the government wanted at the time, what the NLRA was all about was solving problems locally in the workplace. So you didn't have a government agency jumping in and solving this stuff. It was to sit down as somewhat equals and hammer out an agreement. Which is why I'm not thrilled with the idea of an imposition of a contract. I think if a strike is necessary, that's what you have to do. But both parties should hammer it out. And that's what the New Deal era policy did. It said, look, go to the bargaining table, work it out. And it gave, for the first time, workers actual legal footing as having rights. That's a big, big freaking deal. And I would argue one of the things that this generation, people who benefited from my grandparents, you know, basically fighting and dying in the streets for a minimum wage and maximum hour laws and getting children out of mines. We've taken it for granted and forgot or never even knew, because we do such a poor job of teaching labor history, never knew what it was like during the era before the NLRA. Now understand, 1935, long time ago. And we're still operating under those laws. Every amendment to it has been taking rights away from workers. Now, in this, they established the National Labor Relations Board, which is what Lynn Reinhart and I were talking about a moment ago. They're an impartial arbiter to help with disputes between employers and employees. When an employer illegally fires someone, it's the NLRB who hears that case. Employers don't like that because the role of the NLRA is to encourage collective bargaining and to give workers some rights. Employers don't like that because they like the old way. They like the fiefdom. They like the being the king of the castle. They like the master-servant relationship. And as I was explaining to my son the other day, in the old days, and what the NLRA understood is that the employer, well, they control everything. They control what hours you work, what you do during those hours, how you do it, where you do it, what you're paid, all of that stuff. Now, I hear people, well, you could quit. If all the employers are collectively doing the same thing through their front groups, and look, they've always had front groups. Americans for Dogs and Puppies who love workers, you know, name it whatever you want. It's all the same aim. It's the pendulum swing of power towards employers away from workers. And there's nothing more that employers hate than empowered workers and also politicians who want to be dictators, which is why you're seeing the Trump administration going after this little known organization that probably 80%, 90% of the workforce could not tell you what NLRB stands for. But for workers, it's a big freaking deal. So to see someone like this Democratic place, workshop, whatever, this front group going, we just want the attorney general just with the whip of a pen to completely do away with all of the Biden era stuff. You should be concerned. And employers, and I think Lynn is right. I think Lynn is absolutely right. Employers should be weirded out because the one thing the NLRA did is it brought stability. Yeah, we've had strikes, but not like we used to. Not like the strikes my grandfather told me about. Not like that at all. And what the NLRA has done is it's given stable labor relations in this country through good oversight, through arbitration, through government action when needed. The NLRB provides clear guidelines. We know the rules of the game, or at least we used to until, well, you got to wonder now. Offered some bit of conflict resolution so that you don't have to strike. Because look, nobody wants a strike. Employers don't want it. Workers don't want it. They don't get paid. But there are sometimes, well, that's the only option, isn't it? If an employer's dug in, we're not budging. The only power workers really have is the power to fold their arms and march their feet. And this is where the right to strike is so vitally important, and the right to not allow employers to permanently replace striking workers. At the end of all this, it was a system that worked fairly well for 90 years. It had pendulum swings, but what they're about ready to do is not just destroy the bureaucrats. They're going to destroy the pendulum, and it will become a bludgeon for employers until politically it changes. And then it could go somewhere else. It could be a bludgeon for labor. And as someone who believes that at the bargaining table is where you want to be, hammering out the best agreements for both sides. You know, I've often heard it said, if both parties walk away angry, it was probably a good deal. But they're trying to completely undo. And as I've said before, this is part of wanting to undo and overturn all of the progress of the 20th century and return us to the Gilded Age, where the Musks of the world, who oddly enough, benefit from these decisions, but where the Musks of the world, the Bezos of the world, they rule the roost. And, well, you could accept the conditions or you could starve. And it looks more and more likely starve is where they want to take us. I'll tell you, this is bad. My red hat friends, you should be contacting your congresspeople. You should be going, hey, what you doing? This is your world. This is your work here. Why are you letting them, well, pencil whip it out of existence? Because this affects you too. this doesn't care about red hat or blue hat. This is about green. And it's money out of your pocket to theirs. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Share it with me. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Gilmar Abrego Garcia has been moved from a notorious prison to another lockup in El Salvador after being mistakenly deported. That from Senator Chris Van Hollen, who visited Abrego Garcia Thursday. Van Hollen, as he arrived at Washington Dulles Airport today.
His conversation with me was the first communication he'd had with anybody outside of prison since he was abducted.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio declaring that the U.S. was willing to move on from the Ukraine-Russia peace negotiations if they didn't yield results soon, saying, quote, "We have other priorities to focus on as well. It's not our war." A federal judge in Vermont ordering the Trump administration to transfer Tufts University student Romisa Ozturk to immigration police custody in Vermont by May 1st to determine whether she was illegally detained for co-writing an op-ed piece in the student newspaper. She's being held in Louisiana, where the DOJ says the immigration court has jurisdiction. This is ABC News. Houthi rebels say at least